Hey there, this is Jules O'Loughlin, and you're listening to the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Good morning, Ilya. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How about yourself?
People listening to this won't know this, but we're recording this on Election Day. And as I learned in 2016, when I was making an infomercial for a hair plug doctor in Redondo Beach, don't make things on Election Day. Your head's not in it. But here we are. And so I'm a little preoccupied, just, biting the fingernails down to the quick.
All right. Yay. Then let's do our best not to keep this episode too hot and heavy. Who's on the show today, Ben? Who's our guest?
It was an interview you did with Jules O'Loughlin, who shot season two of The Old Man on FX, which is an awesome, awesome TV show. Can't recommend it highly enough. I love
Jules
it.
Jules is awesome. The show is awesome. The interview is really good. I'm really happy about this. I'm glad that it's coming out now. And if you haven't seen The Old Man,
good.
Go back and start watching it. That's a great show. So
I would say don't sleep on The Old Man, but that sounds dirty. I love your American cinematographer hat. For those of our YouTube viewers, you can see the American cinematographer hat.
It was a free piece of swag that came from Camera Image years ago. Also lights. There's a lights patch on it somewhere. I'm not going to try and, show the lights off. But anyway, it's kind of cold here in Portland. So, yeah, we're in the warm clothes.
Man, I want to get some American cinematographer swag. Is anyone from AC listening to this? Get me some swag.
Yeah, we can probably.
Been reading your magazine from cover to cover for like 30 years,
including back issues, including like way, way back. We've talked about this before.
I have a giant collection of American cinematographers. I still subscribe to the print magazine. It's the only print magazine I still subscribe to.
It's a great magazine. It really is, and they have a consistently high level of writing, which is great. And it wasn't always. Always, not every story and thing in there has always been like, $1 million, but they got really good people who are doing really, really good stuff consistently. And boy, hard to argue with what they put out on the regular.
And now, Close Focus.
So Ben, what are we talking about today? What is our Close Focus?
Well, both you and Alana, our producer Alana, had suggested this because, I sort of feel like the whole world is collectively holding their breath over the election, and that's really sucking all the air out of entertainment news. I was listening to The Town with Matt Bellamy, and they were talking about, who they were predicting would get the most ratings for election coverage. Mm. That was where that went. I was like, oh yeah, that's a smart spin. I see what you did there, The Town. But we decided to go in a different direction and talk about the fantastic fights or the fantastic debates at Fantastic Fest, which is, I would say, probably my all-time favorite film festival experience. I've been there twice. It's just one of the best film festivals ever. It's all genre stuff. It's the brainchild of Tim League, Alamo Drafthouse has got bought by Sony or whatever, but like
formerly of Alamo Drafthouse. Yeah.
He is Alamo Drafthouse. He is also like the Alamo releasing, the distributor.
Oh, yeah, gotcha.
They have Drafthouse films, and Fantastic Fest is sort of like Tim's taste writ large. And my feature Alien Raiders, even though Warner Brothers would not allow it to be called a premiere, it premiered at Fantastic Fest in 2008. Mm-hmm. And
was it just semantics? They wouldn't allow it to be called a premiere, but it screened there the first time ever in public. Was that?
They didn't know anything about film festivals. They knew nothing about film festivals, and it was extraordinarily frustrating. Like at one point I asked if we were allowed to be qualified for an award, and they said, well, how do they do it? Do they have an applause-o-meter? Do they give the audience handheld devices? And I didn't say this, but it's like you work in the film business in the marketing
and
wing.
Have never been to a film festival.
Yeah. You live in Los Angeles. and there are several world-class film festivals here. Surely there must be some kind of film that you would like to see that you could go see at a film festival and just experience it, because like they didn't understand why I wanted to take it to film festivals, yada, yada, yada.
It goes to show how out of touch some, you know, like this wasn't that long ago. It was 20 years ago, right? This is something like that. So
not even 20, this is like 15 years ago.
It's like, wow. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. I think that these are people who, like, their job was to market my movie, and then literally the following week, their job was to market Ace Ventura Jr., which is a real movie that came out the week after mine. They don't care about the directors of these movies. The director was like, hey, what if we did something interesting and got a bigger audience for my movie than randos at Target buying dog food, seeing a DVD on a shelf? And it's not surprising, because that was the DVD business model.
It was, yeah.
And it made no sense then, and it makes absolutely zero, negative 5 billion sense now. But it seemed doomed to fail eventually, but somehow it worked. People would go to Target and be like, hey, movie I've never heard of, take my $20. That was how we were. Yeah. That was how silly we were in the aughts before streaming.
You know, I guess if you were looking at the possibility of, hey, if I was going to take my family to a theater, I'm going to spend, you know, 3-4 times this. We can all watch it at home. And if I don't like it, I can go to the used DVD shop and probably get half my money back. So yeah, it was a thing.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, like, I bought a lot of DVDs too. I still have a bunch of them, but anyway, we're not here to talk about this. We're talking about
the fights. We're talking about the Fantastic Fest debate/fights, which, like, I've never been to Fantastic Fest. I had to
the best.
I had to learn about this from the stories and watching some of the YouTube videos. But break it down for the audience. What exactly would happen at this festival that, you know, ended up with two people in a ring punching each other?
Well, here's the thing. Firstly, I want to say of Fantastic Fest, I've been to a lot of film festivals. I've been to Tribeca. I've been to Sundance, et cetera, et cetera. And at film festivals, they create lots of opportunities for filmmakers to meet each other, parties and events and stuff like that. Fantastic Fest is the only festival I've personally been to where they go out of their way to put the filmmakers or actors or whoever's representing the movie in the same room with the film fans. Mm. And there's like no wall between you, and they have they have debates.
It's not like in a roadside bar where people are throwing beer bottles. It's not quite.
No. It's honestly the best. It's the best. Cool. Tim Leake is a consummate showman. I don't know how he does it. He has endless energy. And the Alamo Drafthouse Theater too in Texas. I'm sure they're different now, but because I haven't been there in a while. But we were at the South Lamar Alamo Drafthouse. Beautiful screen. There was a bar that he had in the same plaza called the Highball, and he had karaoke, and he had like Tim really had created sort of his own universe there. And I feel like Fantastic Fest, there's an aesthetic. When a movie like Jason Eisner's Hobo with a Shotgun comes out, I watch it and I'm like, this was made to please Fantastic Fest. Mm. This is a movie that Fantastic Fest audiences will eat up. And so I would call it carnivalesque. And the debates were, they would have a debate. They would have a debate, and they would have like a film critic and a filmmaker, or two film critics or whatever. They would go in and they would have a debate, and then they would fight. They would fight. They'd put on the pads, and like, these weren't real fighters.
No, these are amateurs. So you got a film critic, you got a director, yeah. You put them in a ring, you put on some gloves, and there's a referee. Tell us, how did it go down?
Yeah. I mean, it went down exactly the way you would think it would go down. And I mean, you know, I remember at one point Tim Leake himself got in there, and you're like, oh, you've been training for this. Like, you take this really seriously.
Well, I heard he kicked everything.
Tim
off.
Is awesome. If I can't stress anything more, Tim Leake is an awesome, charismatic, fantastic, cool dude. And he's created like a weird subculture, and it's not just Fantastic Fest, Drafthouse Films, the culture of Alamo Drafthouse. That's all from him. That, to me, that is an expression of who he is, and that's, you know, like, we should all be so lucky as to create an infectious culture around our taste. And that's what's going on there.
All right. So now there's some real controversy about this, though, because they've been doing it for a long time. Tim Leake got in there, I think, initially with I'm going to say it wrong. Uwe Boll. Yeah. And, and
Uwe Boll, the director of,
Blood Rain.
Nothing good. I'm always very careful to come on here and say anything that would be, that would alienate someone who might be one of our guests.
Yeah.
And I hold nothing that Uwe Boll did against any of his cinematographers. Mm. If you needed the work and you took an Uwe Boll movie, good for you. We'd be happy to have you on. That being said, his movies aren't good.
Well, there was a critic who felt the same way that you did and basically called him out, said his movies are...
Because they have eyes and ears that function and a brain stem.
So they called him out and... Uwe challenged him to a fight. He said, "Get in the boxing ring with me." And of course, I don't think the critic did, because I guess Mr. Boll is like an...
No, some critics did.
Oh, did they really? He was an amateur boxer. He was an amateur, like,
He like had a challenge that said that if any critic can beat me in however many rounds of, I don't know, I'm not a boxing fan, but if you could defeat me at this at this pugilism contest that I'm excited to punch you in the face at, I will quit directing. And a few of them took him up on it, and he beat them all, I believe.
Well, I was under the impression that no one did, but that that league from Alamo said, "Hey, I'll do it," and invited him to Fantastic Fest, and that was how the whole thing got going that way.
No, I mean, I believe that is correct. But yeah, there is a little bit of a controversy because, apparently they put like some indie filmmaker in the ring with an MMA fighter, and they now have brain damage. Oh.
That's terrible. All right. Okay. Well, it's controversial. There's some people coming out, drawing attention to this. I haven't heard any statements from Fantastic Fest if this is going away, if this is no longer going to be a thing, or I assume they would have had releases up the wazoo. Anytime you've got people who are intentionally, part of this article that I looked at about this was saying like how it was kind of billed as like a light and friendly thing, but then people get hit in the face and go like, this isn't light or friendly at all. This is serious. So,
well, like I think about, I mean, and I think this is actually a fair comparison. If you and I got into a boxing ring together, like neither one of us is ready to do this. Mm. Like neither one of us would be any good at it. We don't know the moves. So we would just be like happy to land one blow. And I also like wouldn't want to hurt you. And I assume you wouldn't want to hurt me. I think most of it was like that. But then like some people, they take shit too seriously. That happens.
Yeah. Well, and I think that most of these people were not friends before getting into the ring. And I think they get hit a little bit and then suddenly it's like it's just going to escalate. Anyway,
as a showman, that would be what you would want. Like you want to create that kind of viral anger, you want that. That's going to be fun to watch and I remember it was a super fun thing to watch. I had a lot of fun watching it. I don't remember anyone that serious about boxing getting into that ring. It is what it is. But, Fantastic Fest is not a controversy-free festival. It was partly founded by Harry Knowles. And I'm not going to go into it here, but... gross, super gross.
Yeah. Okay. Well, man, film festivals can be a pretty boring affair. It does not sound like Fantastic Fest prescribes that at all. It sounds like they're all about the opposite. They're about like, the spectacle. They're about the experience. You're going to remember Fantastic Fest. I can't tell you how many small regional festivals I went to where it was like, boy, that was forgettable. Not just, because of the movie or the programming, but because everything about it was not set up to be a memorable experience. So, but it sounds like Fantastic Fest stays with you.
Fantastic Fest. Okay. Firstly, one of the best curated festivals I've ever been to. I would say probably my two favorite curated festivals are that and the Florida Film Festival. Just brilliantly curated, great selection of films. And as a genre fan, I mean, like, I know you're not the world's biggest horror fan, but I saw A Town Called Panic, which is a hilarious Belgian stop motion animated feature.
Oh, I've seen some of that. It's nuts. They actually, my local theater shows that before other movies sometimes.
So they made a feature out of A Town Called Panic, and I saw that at Fantastic Fest. I'd never heard of it. Like, that's what you want. You want to go to a film festival and have just wonderful discoveries. And the other thing about it, and this is what's great about Fantastic Fest, is like you want to interact with the people who made the stuff. And I'm not saying you couldn't do that at Sundance, or Tribeca. Tribeca is hard though, because Tribeca is spread out all over New York City. So it's not, it doesn't feel centralized like Sundance does, where it's kind of all in, you know, whatever, these five or six venues. And then, you know, like you're going to all eat lunch on Main Street and you're going to inevitably see somebody. Fantastic Fest, it's like just cramming everybody in the room together. And it's, and they have all, they have the best parties. They have the best everything. Hmm. I mean, I hope that if I ever get my next film made, that I can get it back into Fantastic Fest and actually call it a premiere, because it's really great. Now, I've heard similar things about South By, and Fantastic Fest is sort of a sister fest to South By. A lot of the same people are involved mm-hmm. in it, but South By is also humongous.
It is.
You know, takes over the whole city, and it's also not just movies, it's music, etc. Fantastic Fest is just genre films. If you have the wherewithal to get to Austin, Texas in September to see to go to a film festival, I can't recommend it more highly, unless you hate genre films. And again, it's not just blood and gore. You're not just going to be watching, you know, The Human Centipede over and over again, although that did play at Fantastic Fest. You know,
if someone had asked me if Human Centipede would get worked into the conversation somehow this morning, I wouldn't have guessed. So,
well, I mean, with the election going on today, I'm definitely having Human Centipede related thoughts. Let's just put it that way.
Hey, Ben, I think we should get to the interview. Let's get to the interview.
Let's do it.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Welcome back to the show, Jules O'Loughlin. Hey, it's great to see you again. I know that you did a great interview 2 years ago with Ben, and now I get to sit down and chat with you about The Old Man. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ilya. Great to be here with you.
Hey, you know, look, I have been enjoying The Old Man so much. I know you did part of season one, and now you've done about, it seems like, half of season two. What a great show. For the people who have never seen this show, I mean, I feel like there's all kinds of things that I could talk about. Like, you know, it's sort of a family story, except it involves like the CIA, FBI, and like the Taliban. But really, it's a personal story involving, you know, a young woman and her extended daddy issues.
Her three fathers.
Three fathers, exactly. So, but how would you describe it? How do you describe this show?
Well, when people ask me, you know, what is The Old Man about, I say, it's about this guy. It's about this dude played by Jeff Bridges, who
the dude.
Was yeah. a dude yeah. who was once a CIA agent operating in Afghanistan during the Soviet occupation. And for those who know the little history of Central Asia, the Russians, or the Soviet Union, I should say, invaded Afghanistan in 1979. And I think our hero, Chase, the character played by Jeff Bridges, was probably there in the early 80s. That's when it kind of takes place. And that tends to be season one, covers all of that, those flashback sequences in Afghanistan. But it's about this guy, a ex-CIA agent who operated in Afghanistan during the early 80s. And he's back living in America, and his past catches up on him years later, and he goes on the run. And he's joined by his ex-partner, Harper, played by John Lithgow, who originally is employed by the CIA to chase Jeff, or to chase Chase, and this is present day, when he goes on the run, and they end up teaming up. So, and it's about, I guess it's about the relationships. He has a daughter who he hasn't seen for some years, but who is now working for the CIA. He talks to frequently, and she was somewhat looked after by Harper. She came under his wing, and it's about her relationship with Chase, played by Jeff Bridges, her father, and also Harper, who's kind of like her adopted father.
Yes, she actually has a biological father, a character named Hamzad.
That's right. So Hamzad, who is her Afghan warlord father, and so it's about the relationships of between her and these three men, but also the relationships between these three men, because Hamzat, back in the day, back in the early 80s when Chase was there, he was working with Hamzat, who was an Afghan warlord. He was Mujahideen, and he was working with him in fighting the Soviet occupiers. So they all knew each other back in the day. And then, of course, Chase ran off with Hamzat's wife, fell in love and went back to America with her. And we think in season one that he had this daughter with her, but it subsequently turns out that, no, she was, as you said earlier, she is the biological daughter of Hamzat.
You know, the way that you describe it right now, and is exactly the same conversation I've had now with a couple of people when I'm trying to get them into the show to watch it. It sounds a little like a soap opera. You've got these three father figures. You've got this young girl. There's this whole, all this like intrigue and drama, but really it's not, it's only the inkling of soap opera. This is a dramatic white knuckle. There's these sequences of action and intensity. I mean, it's all played, extremely serious. Talk a little bit about the tone of the show, because I think the tone is actually what's so successful. What draws you in? What draws you into this? Were you attracted to the tone initially, or what's your feeling of, how would you describe the tone of The Old Man?
Well, I'll talk about the tone, and then I'll talk about why I was attracted to it. But you're right, Ilya. I mean, what you were just saying there, it made me think about the analogy of war. And back in the day when I was a younger guy, I was a bit obsessed with the Vietnam War, and I was obsessed with the literature surrounding war, and also films such as Apocalypse Now and Platoon. I was reading Her's Dispatches and Chicken Hawk and a whole bunch of books when I left school about the Vietnam War. And that war in particular was described by someone, and we've all kind of heard this, was as long periods of boredom interspersed with these manic moments of just absolute terror and pandemonium. And while it's not the perfect analogy, because there aren't long periods of boredom in The Old Man, I'm
definitely not.
I've walked into a trap. It's you have these scenes about the relationships between these people that are in themselves very intense, but then you have these periods, these sequences of action or these scenes of action that are really intense. So it kind of, in a way, it reminds me of intrigue and who knows who and whose father and who was doing who in the zoo and what's the relationship between these people and then all of a sudden it's on, and there's a gunfight or that an assassin arrives or in episode 3 of season 2 there's a massive gun battle, and so it's a little bit like war itself, and so tonally it's intense. It's an intense show, but it's captivating, and part of the reason it's captivating is the writing, of course, the scripts, the story. But the other reason, and it's a big reason, are these incredible actors. You've got Jeff Bridges, earlier I said the dude. We all know Jeff. We all love him as an actor, and I've had this incredible privilege to know him as a human being, and I can tell you right now, he is the dude. He is that guy. He's so lovable and he's such an awesome guy and super intelligent. But he does the thing that I got into this business for, and that is to be able to photograph an actor, a great actor doing their thing. And when he and Lithgow are at it, or he and Alia, Shortcut or Amy, are doing their thing in front of the camera, to me that is the most, well, that's why I do what I do. It's not for the action, it's not for the gun battles and the car chases, and while they're all fun, it's about watching two great actors going toe to toe, and so that's why I love coming back to it. That's why I love the show. But the reason what drew me to it, to the material, is that I spoke earlier about when I was a younger man, I was obsessed with the Vietnam War, and then I became, you know, I'm a bit of a world news kind of nut, and I love history, and I, for some reason, you know, there's a couple of things that I really enjoy reading about, and I guess it involves ordinary people under extraordinary in extraordinary circumstances or under extraordinary stress. And so I used to be a climber and I was a mountaineer, and I got right into to mountaineering literature, and that's about ordinary people under extraordinary conditions, you know, where their lives have been threatened, and I guess conflict is like that as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had a brother who lived in northern Pakistan in Peshawar for 3 years and was going into Afghanistan, and I became interested in the area through him, and then I subsequently traveled to Pakistan and did a whole trip through Western Asia. So I was fascinated by the history. And so when I was like a CIA agent, Afghanistan, Soviet occupation, he's on the run, that was like, you know, my eyes were like dinner plates. Yeah, I'm super interested in doing this. And I'm doing it with some people that I've been working with for a few years, my showrunners. So
great.
When they came to me with it, I was like, yeah, let's go.
Yeah, you know, you're exactly right. I was going to say the same thing. It's like, you've got these wonderful punctuation of actions and excitement, but it's all the time that isn't action that I feel like really draws you into the story. And of course it's the writing and the performances, but there is something about the tone. There's something about the ability for you to put yourself into the situation of the characters of like, what would I do that's in this? And it's played just so well. Yeah. I'm also a big fan of world news, and I totally get what you're talking about, because this feels like absolutely a story that was not public, but absolutely comes out of like an era from like the early 80s or something like that, the things that we weren't told of what was going on, because I think it's pretty common knowledge now that we were supporting warlords in Afghanistan against Russia. And we don't hear any of the stories, not the real stories per se, but we know that our government was doing this. So I think it's really fascinating. Let's talk a little bit about the differences between flashback, because there's quite a bit of the show that takes place in sort of like this late 70s, early 80s sort of time period, and modern day. You chose, I think, to let production design really sort of carry the looks, and of course a different cast, you know, between these two different eras. But was there some other conscious choices made with the grade or made with the visuals of it? I feel like there it's a pretty similar look between the two eras.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's funny, you know, in season one, you may know the backstory, but for the listeners, I'll just tell them the backstory is that we started in 2019, and that's when prep kind of started, and started shooting later that year, and then into the next year, 2020, we were going to go to Morocco to shoot all our Afghan flashback material and the present day Moroccan material that takes place in season one, and of course COVID put an end to that. And subsequently, we ended up shooting in north of Los Angeles in the hills of Santa Clarita. And that's where we built our Afghan village. We've done all our Afghan sequences there. And Eric Henry, our VFX super, did amazing work with taking plates shot in the Sierra Nevada, which are also in California, a place called Lone Pine, and compositing them into our Santa Clarita Hills. And as I said earlier, you know, I've traveled to Pakistan, and I've traveled through the Karakoram, and I've seen the Hindu Kush, and those mountains are very particular. They're jagged. They're really dramatic looking mountains. And when I heard that Eric's going to be shooting plates in the Sierra Nevada, I hadn't been to the Sierra Nevada, but I went, really, Eric? Like, I've been to the Karakoram, man, and how are you going to pull it? Anyway, To this day, I haven't been to the Sierra Nevada. I was going to do a trip when we were shooting last time, but I couldn't get out there. But I tell you what, those mountains are so similar to the Hindu Kush and the Karakoram. It's incredible, and the VFX work is just seamless.
It's so good.
It's
so good. It looks like, I don't know if you guys were at Vasquez Rocks, and people who are in LA are probably familiar with Vasquez Rocks, but a couple times it looks like you're sort of like near Vasquez Rocks, but then all of a sudden there's these incredible snowy peaks in the background, which are just composited like on that so well. But I was like, it's great that you were able to fake Afghanistan in Santa Clarita and pull it off so convincingly.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the kind of the visual godhead of the show, and that is it's grounded. That's the word that we keep going back to. It's grounded. The showrunners are very strong on it's got to feel real. You know, we can't use any showiness. I was going to say trickery, but we use trickery all the time, right? It's constant trickery. Mm-hmm. But it can't be showy. You know, it's got to feel grounded and real. When you walk in, when we go into Harper's house in episode five, and these guys arrive and some dark things are going to happen there, it's got to feel like someone's house. It's a real house, you know. And when we're in the hills of Santa Clarita, it's got to look like Afghanistan. So, you know, the one strong, I guess, color palette thing that we did in season one, and we carried it through with season two, is that we used a tobacco filter. And we, in the end, we didn't use a glass filter. We actually made a LUT lookup table. So we photographed through a tobacco filter, and then we had light iron make a LUT, and we could superimpose that on our image as we were shooting, knowing full well that the raw material wouldn't have it. We could always deviate and go wherever we wanted at the end of the season. But we ended up going with that because it was such a great look, it was such a strong look. Now, we used that for the Afghan flashback Afghan sequences, and we also used it for the stateside sequences, you know, where Chase is in. He's on the I always get my coast because I'm from Australia. He's on the East Coast and then travels to the West Coast. So it was used on all the state American sequences, and then when they go to Morocco. And so in season two, that was really important that we continued that look, but we start to branch out into other areas. So in season two, we go to Hong Kong, and the tobacco, that filter, that look just didn't kind of suit the Hong Kong sequences, and it didn't suit the United Kingdom based sequences either. And all of this material, of course, is shot in Los Angeles. So that was, that was the important thing with season one and season two, was that it had to be grounded. The main look, color palette look, is that tobacco filter. And to that end, then production design and costume have to be hand in glove with cinematography. And, and we've had a great production designer. So he was fantastic at working with us and creating these fantastic sets and looks and that we lent into.
Yeah, I got to say, I like it. I feel like it's refreshing because, you know, when you think about your memory, some people, I think that maybe delude themselves a little into thinking that when they think about their memory of something, that it is sort of this Kodachrome, overly stylized, gauzy, diffused thing. I think that's conditioning that we as humans just get from seeing so many things that are so heavy-handed about what the flashback looks like, what the old days are supposed to look like. But this, I think, feels very real and very natural. When I think about my perspective from the time that just I was a child, it wasn't Kodachrome and gauzy. It was very much like reality. There was, you know, yes, the production design is different. I feel like you guys really accomplished that well in this. It feels like
you know, we're getting, we're like we're there back in time. And then we're there with the same sort of color palette. And, you know, the people have changed and the wardrobe has changed and the production design has changed. But clearly it doesn't seem like the camera or lensing really changed. It doesn't seem like there's a bunch of extra filters. It felt like, it feels like we're in the same spot, which is kind of great. So
I mean, of course it was a, you know, it was a discussion.
Yeah.
Like we're having flashbacks. How do we differentiate the flashbacks? Well, we've got different actors playing the young John Lithgow and Jeff Bridges, Harper and Chase. But and so of course it was a discussion. How do we treat those? And it's, and at the end of the day, we just went, listen, the audience are really clever and they're gonna know. They're gonna know straight away what's going on here. And you know, even though they're different actors, we know that, you know, it's story, right? And if the story is strong, the story will hold it. And we don't have to do anything camera-wise to differentiate. You know, it kind of goes into that grounded thing, like keep the show grounded. And it felt to us that if we had given it a different treatment, then we wouldn't have been true to that kind of grounded notion of this story that we're telling, you know, and we trusted that the audience would get it straight away. And of course they do. And it was, you know, once we decided to go down that route, you know, we committed and it was really the right choice for this show. Listen, I love shows where you have a flashback and it's treated in a different way. And, you know, I mean, it's like anything, if you are true to the world that you're building, then you can pretty much do anything, right? And I always, you know, to young cinematographers, and they ask me, oh, what's your favorite? I always talk about Blade Runner. You know, when you really sit down and you look at that film, it's like the lighting is just, it's pretty over the top, right? It's pretty out there. But Cronenworth was so dedicated. He was so true to that look. You know what I mean? He pulled it off, he and Ridley. And so it works and you don't question it. But if you sit scene by scene and really break it down, you go, oh God, there's a couple of guys behind that grate there, you know, with park hands, you know, flashing, you know, this, like, what's that? You know, when you break it down, it's, yeah, it's unbelievable, but it's, he's so true and so committed that it is, the, in my mind, the greatest work of cinematography in cinema history, you know, as far as lighting is concerned. So you just have to be true to what you're doing. And if you do it well, you'll pull it off.
Yeah, I agreed. I think it was spectacular. I think it's a spectacular movie. I watch it every few years too, just to, you know, to have that impact again. I can't watch it too frequently. I like a little bit of time go by. So every time that I watch it, it feels closer to that first time seeing it.
Yeah.
You made a comment actually in an interview that I read some time ago that it was a very specific term that I'd never heard, but I thought it was perfect and I wanted to bring it up so that you could talk about it. Smotherage. I thought smotherage was and you used it in relation to like too much coverage. And we all know the importance of coverage to being able to cover a scene. And I definitely feel like, you know, there's an economy of shots in The Old Man for sure. But it also feels like there's plenty of coverage. There's a lot going on. And I don't know if it's a single camera show or it's a multi-camera show. You tell me. But talk a little bit about the coverage and then your philosophy of smotherage, because I think that's a fun term.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a bunch of things that I have learned or things that I know about the film industry or about filmmaking. And one of them is overcoverage is the enemy of style. And that goes into that word smotherage. And it's kind of used a lot in film parlance in, you know, on the floor of most film sets. If they're just shooting a lot of angles, then that's commonly known as smotherage. So if you have a particular camera style, and we do have a particular camera style, and that's the camera, it's a languid camera style, and it feeds more into It's more into the pace of, say, a track, or the pace of holding on to a shot, or the pace of the editing. It's to do with that. But in season one, we actually did a few sequences that were shot as oneers. You know, in when you see them on the screen, it has the illusion of being a single take. And so, say for instance that you said, right, we're going to make a show, and every scene is going to be a one-er, or let's take the extreme of that, which is Birdman or 1917, mm-hmm. right? Our style, we want the audience to think that it's a single take, and that is going to be the overriding camera style of this show. It's a single take, right? Now, if you start shooting coverage and then editing that coverage in, then that style is gone. And that's the extreme of what I'm saying. You know, single take movie, you're now shooting coverage, you're now shooting a two-hander between you and me, and it's shot reverse, and those two are cut together, and all of a sudden you've destroyed any that style that you were going with. And so to me, I feel as though, from my experience, is that if you have a strong camera style for your show, and unless it's, there is a cater to this, unless it's like a Greengrass, Bourne type movie where it's really super cutty and it's super energetic, and that's your style. Okay, this maybe not work in that sense. But if you've got a more of a languid style and a style and that you want to imbue into your show, and you start shooting loads of coverage, loads of angles, loads of style, loads of sizes, you know, wides, cowboys, mids, MCU, close up, extreme close up, and then the editor starts using all that material, then that sense of style that you wanted to imbue the show with, unless it's like a Greengrass, Jason Bourne, it's going to dilute that camera style. And so that's where I, you know, it's I didn't come up with the term smotherage, but I certainly came up with the sentence, over coverage is the enemy of style. You know, and when you're getting into a coverage fest, and there might be, you know, it's just I've done movies where we've gone with a very particular style, and director's like, well, I want to get this angle, and I feel as though I need this angle, and I'd say, well, don't you think we're deviating from our style? We're starting to shoot smotherage on this now, and I say, if we can't be brave on the floor, then how can you expect, you know, post, you're not going to be brave with the editor in the editing room, right? How can we expect that to be brave there? So, like, be true to, if you have a strong style, a strong camera style, just be true to it. Don't fold. And so, to that end, the old man has that kind of languid camera style. It has minimal kind of coverage. You know, we're not on the floor going, right, we've got to shoot this call sheet, and we've got a three-page scene, and, you know, we need an establisher, we need the wide and the mids and the shot reverse, dirty overs, cleans. Oh, now we're going to shoot a whole bunch of inserts. I mean, it's just not that show. And that's, yeah. That's the whole smotherage thing in a long-winded nutshell. I spoke in smotherage, right?
You did a great job of explaining it to our audience. We get a lot of people who listen to the show, who work in the industry in some capacity, but I will tell you, smotherage, maybe I'm just fortunate to have not been on too many sets where the overshooting of coverage was the reality of the day. I've been there. I've seen one or two, and you're right. It is the enemy of style.
What do you need? Like, if we, when we talk next time, you say, Jules, in one sentence.
Sure. I can do that. Or if you want, I can do a visual reference to.
Talk about Smotheridge in Iwana.
So tell me though, is it a single camera show? Or is the whole thing from that single POV? Do you have a B camera, a C camera? How do you put together the visual language of the old man?
Yeah, no, I mean, we're running two cameras, absolutely. So, and we do shoot coverage. There are times when we have done one-ers, but that is not the show. That's not the overriding style of the show. That's more, we want a languid camera. We don't want to rush things. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got these great actors on screen. We don't want to rush the storytelling. Every time you cut away from someone is, you know, I always say that every time you cut away from a character, you're losing the chance to connect with them. So you just don't want to be cutting, cut, 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 cut. So, but we do shoot two cameras. I mean, we do have a schedule that we have to shoot. And we have, you know, limitations. It's not the type of show that we can just sit with one camera and make it work. We want to, and I'm not always using both cameras. In fact, if the A camera and the A shot is really being compromised by using two cameras, then I'll sit those guys down and they won't shoot. And then the other times, such as the firefight sequence outside the Afghan village in episode 3 of this season, we had upwards of 5 cameras. Mm-hmm. So six cameras maybe we were, and I was even in the mix operating, which I love to do. I came up being a DP operator, but in America it's hard to do union rules and all that, but we're running so many cameras that I got in there and had so much fun. Oh, I love it. I love operating.
And it's a great sequence. Oh yeah, and I totally understand why you'd have so many cameras for that for episode 3 for that sequence, because it's like it really feels like a climax. It's a very much a nail biter, this whole thing that goes down. So I mean, look, I know it's we can certainly talk spoilers, but it's like you've got Humvees with automatic weapons and all kind. You've got helicopters. You got all this stuff going on. The sequence seems like it could be extremely complicated, and it is for, I think, from a logistical standpoint of just to make it happen. And I'm sure there's a lot of visual effects going on, but at some point I have to remind myself, I'm watching a television series. This isn't like, you know, $100 million feature film in a theater that I've gone to go see. This is being done on a television budget and done so convincingly that's kind of amazing to pull off. It's kind of amazing to pull off that level of like production value on a show, which I got to imagine has a pretty tight schedule. Anytime you're doing a series like this, it seems like, can you talk a little bit about that sort of managerial side of being a DP on a show like this, where now, you know, you're the head of the camera, lighting, and grip department. You got two cameras and you've got all this other coordination that's going on. I'm assuming that, like, you know, it's out in Santa Clarita instead of, you know, Afghanistan or Morocco, but you're pulling in techno cranes, you're pulling in all kinds of extra special GAC for those days. How do you plan? Are you planning it 6 months in advance? What's your management solution and workflow for something like that?
It's a big endeavor. It's a big endeavor. And I always say, fail to plan to fail, you know. So, or another saying, which was my one of my film school lecturers back in Australia, was a film is made in pre-production. It's executed in principle photography. So it's all about the planning. And so we started with we start with the script, of course, and then we make storyboards. We have storyboards drawn. And from storyboards, then we go into pre-vis. And so everything is kind of planned meticulously as far as story vis-a-vis shots. And so then what happens is you start going into the planning with your stunt coordinator and all your stunties, and also your special effects guys as well. So it all becomes then about what is the story, what's taking place in this battlefield, who's actually doing it, who's playing the parts, are they principal cast, are they stunt doubles, and so that's all kind of worked out. And then it's like, okay, what beats happen in this moment? What action beats happen in this moment? You know, a 50 caliber gun's going off here. This wall's being disintegrated. Up on the hill, Chase has got a sniper rifle and he's firing that weapon. Okay, down to the action beat. Who's he hitting down here outside the village? What bad is he? Is he taking out? Where's the pyro? Where's the smoke? Like, there's just so many moving parts. So it takes all that planning. And as I said, it first starts on the page and then it goes to the computer and then it goes to the location. You start walking through the location. And so these are all the things that are happening. And then the things that I'm have to be, you know, I'm principally responsible for is the lighting. And the photography, which is all the camera work. So I've got to work out how many cameras I need, what lenses I need to pull off this sequence, what machinery I need to pull off this sequence. So, hey, is it handheld? Do I need easy rigs? Okay, I need there's some controlled crane works. What kind of crane do I need? Is it technocrane? Is it 50? Do I employ a 23 as well? How many cranes? What about drones? There's a helicopter attack, so I need some drone work done there as well. Where are all the cameras placed? So it's a mountain of planning that goes into it, and you know, if you're lucky enough like I was to do it with a seasoned warhorse like Steve Boyum, then not only is it fun, but it's, you know, it's effective and powerful and really satisfying. So,
yeah, and I got to imagine that when you then end up watching the whole thing, when you see it all, you know, I assume that there's, you know, a long post process and there's color grading and you've seen it a million times, but what is the, you know, getting to that point, what is it then like for you when you see it on the screen? What's the satisfaction level when you really pull it off on a show like this?
Well, I mean, because I've seen it in some iteration so many times from the moment where she, you know, from me looking down the viewfinder, because I'm doing handheld work in that sequence, and then going back to the monitor and watching replays of what all my other operators are doing, you know, that's the first iteration, you know, and getting back to that thing of operating, there's nothing better than I think than being an operator and looking down that viewfinder, and there's no one else. You're alone in the cinema. You're sitting in that middle row, in the middle seat, and you're watching the screen, and all you've got in front of you are the actors and the stunt men and the stunt women and this action sequence taking place. And so that in itself, that's the first kind of like, wow, this is awesome. Mostly, I would say, I tried to disassociate as the filmmaker and watch as an audience. Mm-hmm. But I can't help but going, oh, wow, that's awesome. Oh, I'm so glad we pulled that off. Oh, isn't that a great moment? So it is hard to sit back as an audience member when you're watching your own. Some people often say, oh, well, you know, when you're watching movies, you're breaking it down. And, well, listen, if the story is good enough, I'm not even hopefully thinking about the lighting and the camera work. I'm just immersed in the story. But when you're watching your own show, you just, like, it's, I defy any filmmaker to go, oh, yeah, I wasn't worried about, you know, my costumes or, my sound or, you know, the color grading. No, it doesn't happen. Yes. You can't. It's too hard to disassociate. But I was really thrilled. I was tickled pink as they say.
Well, anyway, I'm totally blown away by this show. And quite often, I'm one of those critical eyes. I'm always looking at those things going, oh, yeah, that's interesting. I wonder how they... Oh, and that. I don't do that with this show at all. This show, for me, just washes over me. It's so much fun. It's the great performances, yeah. Great work. I'm really very pleased for it. I know they haven't officially announced if there's going to be a season 3, but I hope there is. I'm looking forward to it if they do.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope there is too. They're amazing characters. They're so nuanced. You know, I was watching episode 5 just yesterday, and watching Chase, Jeff Bridges, down in the basement of Harper's house, about to go to work on this Russian captive that they've got. And by go to work, I mean, you know, if you know anything about the show, you know what I mean. And it kind of struck me, I went, he's so compelling. He's so, this character is so multifaceted. There's so much depth to him. And he's such a great father, a great guy to his, well, to a certain extent, a great father. He was not there a lot, but but he loves his daughter so much, and in many ways he's so honorable, but he's so wicked as well.
Yes, indeed.
Right? Like, he's got a black heart, and it struck me as, like, he's such a compelling character. Like, is he like a Hannibal Lecter? Do we love him? Are we enamored by, do I love him? Do I, like, wow, what is this relationship that I have with this character? But I want to go back and know more. You know, when you talk about a season 3, I've got no idea yet whether there's going to be a season 3. Nothing's been announced. But I would love to go back and, you know, find out more about this character, because he is just so compelling. You know, so it's, let's hope there's a season 3.
You know what, Jules, this has been so much fun. This has been a great conversation. And I think that's a really good place for us to leave it. I hope that you'll come back next time you've got something great to talk about.
Love talking to you guys. It's always a thrill. Thank you.
Where can people find you on the socials? If I recall correctly, I think you have an Instagram or something. Where can people track you down if they want to follow to see what you're up to next?
On my Instagram, which is jules.o'loughlin. That is my handle on Instagram. Great. Should I spell that for you?
It's not necessary. You can go to our official website, camnoir.com. We'll have the show notes for this episode, and we will have a link there to your Instagram. Is there anywhere else? Or is that your
primary? Listen, I'm on Facebook, but I don't use it much. I'm on Threads, which I'm more of a, I use Threads as kind of like a news source, mm-hmm. more than anything. But Instagram is kind of my creative, is where I creatively output some of my stuff. So I do a lot of photography, and I post that to Instagram, and I always post behind the scenes stuff after the shows come out. So I've just done a recent post on The Old Man, and I always post the trailers to my shows there. But yeah, that's where people can see what I'm up to and where I am and what I'm doing. So Instagram, yeah, that's the best one.
Dynamite. Well, I really look forward to seeing what you do next. Thanks again for being on the
Thanks,
show.
Thanks, Leah. Cheers, mate.
All right, so that was Jules O'Loughlin. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Jules. Can't wait to see what you do next. Also, everybody, go watch The Old Man on FX. It's on Hulu right now.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Freaking awesome show. My God, what a great show.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I can't wait to see what happens next, because it's that show's got some great cliffhangers. It's really good though.
And now, Short Ends.
All right. So Ben, it is our Short End time of the show. It's when we talk about our pet obsessions, the things that we are really into every week. Is there a thing that you are into that you want to bring up this week?
I want to plug something.
Oh,
okay. A little bit of a log roll. Although I make no money from this. So before anyone asks, I profit nothing from this. There is a new edition of the Blair Witch Project that was released on Blu-ray by Second Sight, which is a British company. And unfortunately, it is Region B's or whatever region England is. So you would need to have a region-free Blu-ray player to play it. But I want to explain to you what they did because it's freaking amazing.
I have one of those Blu-ray players, so that's interesting.
Okay. I'll need you to recommend me a brand because now I need to get
okay.
one. So here's what they did. Okay, if you saw the Blair Witch Project ever before, if you, let's say you saw it in the theater when it first came out, I'll take it back to Sundance, 1999.
Okay.
Here's what you saw. The movie was shot on analog Hi-8. I own the camera, by the
way.
And
no credits.
Analog Hi-8 and black and white 16 by our mutual friend, the late, great Neil Fredericks, as DP. Black and white 16 millimeter. So the black and white 16 millimeter was transferred to beta SP, standard def for those people who don't know all the random formats.
Okay.
And then, of course, the standard def Hi-8 was also transferred to beta. The movie was edited in that. Then it was exported to either beta or digibeta, standard def, sent off to a company out here in LA called 4MC. They did a 35 millimeter transfer, which is essentially a high-tech way of saying filming a monitor. That's what played at Sundance, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So then some minor changes were made to the movie between the Sundance release and the theatrical release. Mm-hmm. And that's what you would have seen in the theater. Same thing. Standard black and white 16 millimeter, transferred to standard def, blown up to 35. And then, of course, the Hi-8 blown up to 35. That's what you saw. Then, if you've ever seen the Blair Witch Project on home video before this edition, what you saw was the 35 millimeter print of the Blair Witch Project, which again was standard def to 35, yeah. Then they transferred the 35 millimeter print again to video and made DVDs, Blu-rays, broadcast copies.
And for people who don't understand, in the analog world, that is a generation off of a generation there. That's going downwards in quality.
Yeah. And it's not, and honestly, it's not like we had it on VHS and then transferred it to Hi-8 and then transferred it to beta and then that's what you saw. That would have at least been like steps in a similar direction. It's like standard def to 35 millimeter film, back to standard def. Like it doesn't look the way it looked at all. And Neil, who again, he died 20 years ago, but he's the DP, up until the last freaking time I spoke to Neil, was still complaining that when they did the theatrical release, he wanted them to go back in, cut the negative of the 16 millimeter and splice that into it. So at least the 16 could really shine because what you were seeing was 16 transferred to standard def, transferred to 35, but you could have just optically blown up the 16 millimeter and had one less generation.
Way
would have looked a lot better. So here's what Second Sight did.
Okay.
They got the original Hi-8, all of the original source tapes. They still exist. Mm-hmm. They rescanned all of them.
Mm. Okay. So,
and the 16, same thing. Transferred it, I believe, 2K. Mm.
Okay.
And then some poor schmuck over there who I don't envy their job. Or schmucks, some team of people had to re-edit the whole movie from the whatever 20 hours of footage that the actors shot.
Wow.
And they put it all together. So and my hope, my sincere hope is that that Lionsgate, who owns it, will make a DCP out of this so that if you ever see it in the theater again, it'll be from this. So now the video actually looks like video, which is what it should look like because that's what it was. And the 16 really looks like 16. And they released this giant mega edition of it. And in addition to that, all of us who worked on it participated in a documentary directed by the amazing Jed Shepard. And it's the longest interview I've ever sat down for. I've been interviewed a handful of times in my life. This was like a 2-hour interview.
Wow.
And he made a behind the scenes making of documentary about it using footage no one's ever seen before. Some of our behind the scenes footage, some outtakes from the shooting of the film. So, it's pretty amazing stuff.
Did he hand you a bundle of sticks and said, make a stick man.
I would have done that except, the interview, he's in England and I'm in LA. So the interview was conducted over Zoom, but like we went to a real studio and it was actually, I was like, yeah, this makes total sense. But like I was talking to a laptop being interviewed by a laptop.
All right.
But he interviewed all of the principal people involved in making the movie, except for the actors. And I think that that's because of the controversy around the actors that I have talked about. But they talked to both the directors, Ed Sanchez, Dan Myrick, Greg Hale, the producer, Mike Minello, the other producer, and myself.
Excellent.
I don't recall if they talked to, I think they talked to Rob Cowie. I'm not sure if they talked to Rob Cowie.
That's super cool. So it's available like on a Blu-ray or 4K UHD?
Yeah, it's a Blu-ray. I don't think it's 4K, and I think that why would you release this movie in 4K?
I don't know, but I mean, to get more money, that's kind of a thing. Usually you get to add $5 to the price you put it out on the UHD Blu-ray, so.
Yeah, I just, I mean, like, you know, most of the movie is shot on standard F video.
I think a Blu-ray is going to be more than enough for this movie. 100%. I think it'll be great. So, but it sounds
but
like
anyway, it's the 25th anniversary of the movie, wow, which makes me feel super old. but anyway, and it kind of teed me into Second Sight. Like, I actually just ordered from them Session 9, which if you haven't seen that, if you like a good spooky ass movie, Brad Anderson's Session 9 is freaking amazing, starring David Caruso of all people.
Yeah, that's David Caruso. There's a name I wasn't expecting.
Yeah. It's David Caruso and the Human Centipede. I always try and subtly work them into every conversation, both of them. It's like extra points. It's like my bingo card of random things to talk about. Anyway, so check it out. You can go to Second Sight's website. Check it out. If you have a region-free Blu-ray player, let me know what you think.
Awesome.
If you're a fan of it. If you're not a fan of the Blair Witch Project, by all means, do not buy this. It's not any different. It just looks better.
Yeah, you know, my kids have never seen it, so maybe that would be the way to see it, for them to see it. And I got
the time has come.
Yeah, they're old enough. Yeah, this would be appropriate. So yeah, maybe I'll do it.
Man, I can't wait till my son's old enough to show him stuff like that. I don't know. I mean, eventually I'll probably have to show him the Blair Witch Project, but I just want to show him, you know, like John Carpenter's The Thing or whatever.
It'll be here before you know it. Don't you worry.
Human Centipede, second sequence. Martyrs.
You've got a lot.
I always have people say, like, oh, my kid likes horror movies, but they're not scared by any. I'm like, I can give you some recs. Go check out, take them to see Martyrs. Get Martyrs. That'll live in your head for a while. Such a good movie. Anyway, but we're out of spooky season. I'm not allowed to talk about it. It's all
for half the country stuffing. Watching the election results tonight is going to be a horror movie.
Oh my God. I'm crying tears of sadness. Yeah. So Ilya, what is your short end today?
Well, my short end is something that I slept on. It's something that I really am enjoying, and I'm so glad that I'm going back to it. But, you know, the whole streaming wars transition sort of thing happened a couple of years ago, where I was watching Better Call Saul up till 2022. I basically was like, you know, a new season came out of Better Call Saul. But then AMC decided to get their own streaming service. And I was like, as much as I like Better Call Saul, I'm not going to subscribe to AMC. I think I have all of these other like streaming services. I'm like, you know, I'm not going to do it for Better Call Saul. Maybe I'll, you know, maybe there'll be some other way for me to watch the final season of it. But I just could not bring myself to spend another $6 or $7 a month or whatever it was. So Better Call Saul was the sacrifice. I did not watch the last season of Better Call Saul. It's now on Netflix and now I'm watching it. And holy crap, I had to go back. It's been years now. I had to go back and I watched the season recaps of every single season leading up to it, and then the last episode of season 5, so I was in the right mindset so I could get back into it. But season 6 is fantastic, and I just finished last night episode 5, which is Black and Blue, which is a dynamite episode in which Jimmy McGill, you know, also as Saul Goodman, gets essentially suspected or caught by his former boss, played by Patrick Fabian, from you know, HHM law firm, and has him meet him at a boxing ring in the middle of the night, and then says, "Hey, I know you've been gaslighting me. Get in the ring. Why don't we settle it right now with a boxing?"
Wait
match.
A minute, I'm seeing another theme coming. Yeah,
I was going to say, right, like, yeah, you know, the fact that we ended up talking about this for a Fantastic Fest was really funny to me, because really, this sort of like amateur boxing sort of a sequence was something I already wanted to talk about from, you know, Better Call Saul. Better Call Saul has so many of these great moments in the show. And I know there's people who
never really gave it a chance or just didn't want more Breaking Bad in their life. I feel like you don't even have to have ever seen Breaking Bad to enjoy Better Call Saul. Of course, it helps. It definitely helps. But it is such a solid show that stands on its own. And the season six is absolutely on par with all the seasons before. And every episode, as it ticks down, I think there's 13 episodes. And that's it. It's all sort of like building to this climax. And I can't wait to see how it ends. We know that, you know, there's a jump forward that happens in time. We're not seeing that jump forward in time yet. So there's some stuff that happens after Breaking Bad, which is really cool. So it'll be interesting to see how this all goes together.
I was way into Better Call Saul. Spoiler, earmuffs people, if you didn't watch it at all. But when the Michael McKean character died, I lost all interest in it. I loved the show. I loved that dynamic, and I lost interest. And I have thought about repeatedly. I've thought about going and trying to finish the series because, you know, to me, Breaking Bad is one of the all time best TV shows, and Better Call Saul was awesome. I just really loved the dynamic between those two characters. And I remember the next season kind of finding it hard for the series to get traction in my brain without that dynamic.
Well, there's callbacks to that happen too. And that ends up, you know, that ends up being a real thing in Jimmy's life. So it's I hear you. Cause that's, but I think that brave shows kill off strong and, notable characters. They do. They have,
yeah, impact. I'm not saying that they shouldn't kill off characters. I'm saying that, like, I love that dynamic. And after it was gone, it was hard for me to.
All right. Well, I'd wager that there's other really good dynamics that happen.
I should get back into it. Also, like, all this happened when, my son was under the age of 3 and, maybe under the age of 4, and I had no attention span. So I have a better attention span now, and maybe I could watch it now.
All right. Well, Better Call Saul season 6, the entire show now available on Netflix. So if you've got a Netflix subscription, you can catch up on it. It is my obsession of the week. I can't wait to see another episode tonight. I can basically make it through one before falling asleep. So it's like I know for like the next week or so. That's what I'm going to be doing. Maybe I'll be doing it instead of watching election results. That might be my thing tonight.
That sounds delightful.
Oh, man. All right, Ben, I think that just about.
And the thing is, anyone listening to this has the advantage of knowing how today went, which we don't.
That's true.
So, like, yes, we're not going to know about today for another 12 hours. And it's going to be 12 long hours. And there still might not be a result. And you might be listening to this being like, hey, Ben, you freaking jamoke. We're not going to know for another week.
Yeah, okay, these things could be true. All could be true. Anyway, well Ben, yeah. I think that just does this episode. Where can people find you? Where can people find you? They want to find you.
You can find me at benrock.com, just the way it sounds. Check out my socials. I should also say that I worked on an escape room that's opening up this week in Seattle. So anyone listening to us in Seattle, you can see some work that I don't go for my work, but I mean, like, I'm proud of my work. My work came out great, but Hourglass Escapes is doing a Lara Croft themed Tomb Raider escape room in Seattle.
You get to be the Tomb Raider. You get to strap on two guns and.
No. Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, you get to, well, no, Lara Croft is a character in it. And I filmed all the wraparound stuff. I directed it with my good friend Yuri Lowenthal and Brian Krasner. So check it out. But anyway, yeah, that's where you can find me. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
You can find me over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. Come to us for any sort of camera, lighting, post gear you might need. We got all kinds of stuff. We got like 10,000 items on our website. And that's where you can find me. So Ben, who do we have to thank this week? Who made the show possible?
Number one, Michael Dispenza, who's editing, doing the slicing and dicing and making us not sound like idiots. I'll be interested to see which part of the Fantastic Fest conversations made the cut. I hope Human Centipede. Oh, that's geez. All I have. And we got to thank Kaze Alatrakshi, who composed all the music that you're hearing in this episode. Check him out at musicbykaze.com. Hire him to do all the things he does, which include composing, visual effects, color correction, and directing.
I saw Kaze about a week ago. He was speaking for Sigma at the Sigma.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, like, you know, there's that idea of jack of all trades, master of none. That's bullshit. We live in a world where you have to be a generalist, and Kays is, I will say this, everything he does, he is a master of it. He works towards mastery. He is so good at all those things. I would have literally no problem hiring him to do any of them. Lastly, oh my God, but not leastly, we have to thank Alana Cody. Alana Cody, who is the beating heart of this podcast. Without her, we would put out, 0.5 episodes every 7 months. And we wouldn't be getting the caliber of people. And also sometimes we wouldn't even have a good close focus.
Yeah. So if someone out there is like, how do we make a podcast like this? You have to hire Alana, because that's really the whole reason we have a show like this.
She's the best. I'm very thankful for her every day that we do this. And just every day, because she's an awesome person. Yeah.
All right. So Ben, that was wonderful. Thank you for wrapping it up there so succinctly. I know that was a really long, like, thank yous that we just did.
Well, you take us out.
Thanks for tuning in.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.